good society should provide sinew for revolt as well as for power. And I think that Danny Dorling is that sinew. So I'm very happy to welcome part of that sinew, and I'm very happy to welcome you here, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say, Danny.
Thanks very much. And what Michael also said is you need many, many, many people. And he was one of many. The main thing I want to talk to you about tonight is the difference between his time, when he was involved in writing the 1945 manifesto. If you think about what was in that manifesto, it was dramatic, starting at Open University, the idea that you could do that and it would work. He was in a time when you had lots of ideas. The ideas appeared originally to be often mad. You know, when they were first presented 20 or 30 years before they got into a manifesto, there'd be things that most people wouldn't think were possible. 20 or 30 years after a manifesto, there'd be things that you thought, why didn't you do this? Wasn't it obvious? And I think one problem of our current times is that we have a lack of new ideas, which is one reason why we have such a high level of social inequality, why it is harder than it might otherwise be to begin to turn it round. This event is supposed to be about the launch of the second edition of a book I wrote 5 years ago called Injustice. The book is pretty depressing, I have to warn you. It's particularly depressing because it's become a centimetre thicker in the second edition, because lots of things have got absolutely worse in the last 5 years. So things that I wrote about 5 years ago, where you might have said, or you are complaining a bit too much, you know, say about people having to begin to go to beg for food, now you're fully aware that we have many people go to food banks and so on. So 90% of the book is really a moan and a catalogue of statistical examples of things going wrong, things like private nursery fees being 4 times higher now than they were 5 years ago for the elite and so on. Quite incredible things that have occurred. But 10% of the book is about new ideas, ways of thinking how it could be different and why you need them. And there are many people who have new ideas, but as yet we don't have an environment that's particularly welcoming to new ideas. So in the part of politics that I'm in, which is the left-green kind of part, we have lots of campaigns to defend things that we weren't in the past. Things like defend council housing, defend comprehensive schools, defend a set of welfare benefits that we're about to lose. We have far fewer campaigns to instigate new things. And the campaigns that we had in the past to instigate new things were more positive, because they weren't about trying to keep something that had worked and might still work, but was actually a solution to a past problem. You needed mass building of council estates because they were much better than slums. You try and argue now for building council estates again, where every house is a council house, and you won't get mass popular support. I'd argue you need to think of something else. What I'm going to do is do a kind of cradle in the grave thing in the next 35 minutes and just go through, from birth through to death, ideas and things that we could do differently. It's a very old-fashioned way of doing this. It was, if you like, the style of the 1945 manifesto. It was the style of the Beveridge Report and the Gavin Beveridge Report. The positive thing, I think, if you believe what I think I found in the book, is that a lot of our problems are not intractable. They are not problems of living in a global capitalist system. Mainly for the reason that we are a really strange country. Almost all of the other richest 25 countries in the world do many things better than us, have lower rates of poverty, children do better in education, they house themselves better, housing is cheaper, people's jobs are less precarious, and so on. So, in one way of looking at this, I often kind of think I'm blessed that I don't live in Finland. Because if you lived in Finland or Norway, which are countries with some of the lowest rates of child poverty in the world, some of the best education systems, and you're a social scientist, I don't know, you know, what do you do? you've really got to come up with something new and be better. Whereas quite a lot of, I think what we need to do in Britain is try to work out why are we so odd, and how do we begin to learn from other people, as well as come up with ideas of our own. But positive things, so it's going to be unashamedly positive. I can get negative eating, we'll do that in questions later. We do not have a cabal of really clever, nasty people trying to make things worse. We do have a cabal of nasty people trying to make things worse, but they're not clever. No, they're supremely confident. And it would be far more worrying if they were clever. Most of their ideas were pretty well formed by the age of 21. I would include people like the Governor of the Bank of England, who I heard speak recently. Well, I don't think anything he said you could have heard much differently from a 21-year-old economics graduate back in the 1980s. I think our leading politicians, their ideas were formed in the 1980s when they were at university, if not before. Haven't been much challenged, and they've been in a group that have fought similar things ever since. I may be biased, Theresa May did her geography degree in my department, and I always think that when she suggests things, you know, who was it who was teaching her? And you know, what kind of things makes her worry so much about innovation and so on? So let's start off with good news. This is a map of the world. We've stretched the map so that every area is proportional to the number of people. We have about 7.3 billion people in the world at the moment. It appears to be going up quite quickly, but it's only going up because people are aging, because mortality is falling dramatically worldwide. Population is set to peak in the lifetimes of our youngest children for the first time since the Black Death. This is an incredible change worldwide. It's an uncelebrated change. We hit peak baby in about 1990, we're at peak 25-year-old in the world now. Over half the world is below fertility replacement level. All of Europe is below fertility replacement level. Even the United States in the last 2 years has got below fertility replacement level. There's Europe. We're that little place on the edge. We're about 1% of the world's adults. We're about 0.5% of the world's children. It wouldn't have been possible when Michael Young was writing, to talk about population in such a confident way. Because when Michael Young was writing, population was not just rising, but the rate of increase was rising each year. The rate of increase in the world reached a peak around about 1971, when annually world population was going up by 2% a year. And if you think of the 2% annual rise, that was the highest rise we'd ever seen in world population. Somebody wrote back in the late 1960s that if this rate of increase were to continue for 300 years, the entire planet would be covered in people all touching each other, which, if you were very prescient in the 1960s, would have told you that you were living through a very strange time that was going to end. Very shortly after that mathematician said that the current rate of increase means that the planet will become a seething mass of human bodies, the fertility rate began to fall, and so it's been falling ever since 1971. The main reason why we may get to 10 or 11 billion people is because people like you are going to live to your 70s or 80s. There's not more births. These kind of things change what's possible. Another very good news story. About 3 years ago, the infant mortality rate in the world fell by 5 percentage points in just 1 year. If you're thinking of bad things that happen to people, the death of your child, I think, is probably the worst thing that happens to people. There are fewer people in the world who experience death of their children than there were in the 1970s, even though there are far more people. So things are changing rapidly. The reason for the switch around is the emancipation of women. That is the only thing that fits this change. A half emancipation of women has occurred over this time period. There are lots of things that can be celebrated worldwide, and we tend not to celebrate. But we worry too much, I think, about problems that have stopped being problems. 1% of the world's people, only 0.5% of the world's children. If we are lucky, our population may go up a bit. Lucky from the point of view that our national debt will decrease. Ones won't be on if we get more immigration. Lucky because of who actually comes here. You really don't want to be a part of the world where people are leaving. We're the California of the world. California 1960s is what London is like now. It can create all kinds of problems, but to see it as a problem in itself is a ridiculous thing to do. But I think if you begin to turn around and see things like that as beneficial. I'll give you one example of the benefit of highway to immigration. London schools in the 1980s were amongst the worst in the country in terms of exam result. London schools, the bottom 10% of London state schools, now do better than whole counties like Norfolk and Suffolk. The main reason is immigration. The secondary reason is because of the new Labour government, which politicians like to talk about quite a lot, but the immigration was far more important than that, because they were spending in other places that we can see that change. The third reason is that teachers, London can get teachers, because teachers can get partners in London who are paid better.
So they subsidise.
You can worry about things going wrong. So if you take the London education improvement, we've just seen a change in London and the country that's quite dramatic, so that about 20% of all our children in England are now living in houses that's private rented. In London, the private rented sector is going up by 1% a year. Every year we will be a 90% private rented city. If this were to carry on by 2050, it won't, I don't think. It's very high. The London Poverty Report released last week showed that there are 250,000 children in London who are living in poor households, households below 60% of median income, who also have a private landlord. That's more poor children in London with a private landlord than in council housing. The reason why that matters is that if you've got a private landlord and you've got children, you're talking about moving every 2 years. If you really want to destroy the educational achievement of inner London, it's about the fastest way you could do it is by allowing private landlords to take over the housing that group who did better saw. So we can see how many things are connected. We do need to worry about the fact that people can't have children, feel they can't have children. This is one thing that has got worse very recently. I like the 1970s. I'm unlike other people who I think the 1970s have been much maligned. It wasn't just that we can remember the long hot summer of 1976. That's just natural, it's good. There were lots of things wrong in the 1970s. Racism was worse, people were stabbed. That's around here today. You know, many years was the standard deadline. But in the 1970s, you could get a job, you could leave your job, if you didn't like your job, and you could get another job. That's a labour market that works. You could also get a house or flat if you could get a lover, which was easier in the 1970s, despite lack of internet. And you could start a family in your 20s. And that was for working class people and middle class people. One of the things that's gone badly wrong is the way in which so many people feel that they can't start a family. Now, if I talk to people a generation older than me, so we could be really brave. It does require a degree of bravery to bring a baby into the world when you've got a tiny flat and your landlord's putting the rent up by 5% every year. So I think if we're looking at things that we need to change, we need to say that people should be able to do what people have always been able to do. And it isn't going to create a huge problem, because there is no way we're going to get back up to having two children on average. Even Sweden, with its pro-data policies, hasn't managed to do that. Even China has finally worked out that they can get rid of the one-child policy, because in the areas where it has already got rid of the one-child policy, it's found out people don't want to have two children. It's actually got worried about too few children. But we do need to change things. So I'm going to go through a couple of things. I've only got about 7 slides, so don't worry, it's not going to be death by PowerPoint. In fact, it might not be death by PowerPoint at all if I can't work out how to get to my next slide. Let's work out.
This is next.
I've got to work out how to click to that. Could you click the next one, please?
Absolutely, I'll be your beautiful assistant. You. I had no idea how to do this. Oh, I mean,
that's what
happened to me yesterday with
30 school children
here, and it was
excellent.
Up the top.
Education.
Up the top.
Right, people should be able to have children. We need to wear our childcare.
It says next, right?
It should not be unsolvable.
Yeah,
we've got a graph, okay. But let's start thinking about our schools. This goes back to thinking about the Fair and Comprehensive School campaign and the amazing things happening to our schools at the moment. We have two kinds of, well, we actually have 57 varieties of school, but broadly two kinds. We have charity schools that people call private or independent schools, but I call them charity schools. The key thing about them is they're not for profit. Right, the very rich are not so stupid as let somebody wanting a profit educate their children. We have the charity schools and then we have the state schools. The state schools, we are currently converting to free schools and academies. The academies are run by the Board of Eight Trustees. The main criteria to be a trustee of an academy is you're an accountant. This is a wonderful natural experiment for the world to show what happens if you do this. We're sacrificing our children's future to demonstrate what will happen if you allow accountants to take over our schools. And it might not be good for us. What I'm showing you here are international test scores on ability in maths. We get exactly the same pattern when we look at ability in problem solving. Problem solving is, if I show you the net of a cube, can you work out that it's the net of a cube? That is problem solving. So we're not talking very, very complicated things here. And literacy. And what you'll see is that in the unequal countries in the rich world, which is the US and us, and Singapore, but in R2, we don't do that well at maths. Whereas in the more equal countries of the world, apart from Singapore, we'll talk about that in a bit, they do better at maths. We have more competitive schooling systems. We are examining people again every year of their lives, children every year of their lives. Last month we brought in the first baseline tests for 5-year-olds, which included, can you recognise the twin arches of McDonald's? You get one more point for at the age of 5 if you can. So we have a test-obsessed culture, and I've reflected it by talking about how in London's done so well. It's by GCSE results. This in effect is sort of GCSE results because it's age 15 ability. So generally better here, be better at maths, where there's less competition in the society, where it's less important what exam mark you get, than here, where it's absolutely vital to get a C. To get a basic job, you have to get a C to get a basic job. You have to get an A or an A star to get into the Boston University. So we try very hard, but we don't do as well. Now, if you can click forward one more, what I think is really fascinating, and I'll just show you this because it's like a new graph. This is the same test, but taken up to age 24 in 2012, latest data. And suddenly things line up much better. Singapore didn't do the test. We don't know about Singapore. But what's incredible, and I think when you start talking about our schools, we and Nikki Morgan, bless her. What? I what weren't to say. Anyway, it's like the Golden Project computer program. So that when he left, he would carry on. He had that obsession with some marks. This is maths. By the age of 24, with our highly competitive school system, worrying for years and years about getting people's maths results up, we teach maths in a way that means you don't know it by the age of 24. But what we're doing in our schools is we are teaching people to get a C or an A. And we're doing this in everything. Other countries don't do it. They teach maths in a way partly that I feel I was taught in the 1970s when nobody actually cared because there were no league tables in the 80s. I was lucky enough to be taught maths by a maths teacher who actually loved maths. I'm a bit geeky, I quite like maths. I wasn't pushed to get that extra A or A star in further maths that somebody could have done if they were really off that score. That thing you need to really turn you off maths, what's turned many of you off maths is some feature or talent making you just push yourself at a particular age a little bit higher than you were comfortable with so you could get that mark that you needed. Whatever we've done, the United States have done with all its charter schools, which were a lovely idea when it began. Charter schools began with the idea that teachers were being controlled them and are now, and we've copied. So we've created an education system which gets people A's and A stars and C's on a particular date and makes sure that they don't learn much about that subject which they have on their CV. So something's badly wrong with our schools. You know, if you're going to begin to address things, I think you need to start from this. Examining, talking about getting children up, realising every child's potential in the way we've been doing it, actually damages our children compared to children in other countries where they do things in a different way. So wide variety of different ways in other countries. It took Denmark 250 years to get this particular school system. Finland did it faster to get to a 99% state system with teachers well paid and with autonomy to decide how they want to do it. Yeah. But there's loads of them to look at. The key thing is that you don't go here, which is where we have been flying over, and Labour did it before the Conservatives and Gove went every year to education conferences in the States. You don't look here to learn how to have an education system that means somebody by the age of 24 is new book. So then what do you do? What do you do with schools? I think the second thing to realise with our schools, with the academies and the free school program. Free schools are, I'm in favour of volunteer schools, I'm in favour of people being allowed to experiment and do things. I'm not in favour of it being completely unregulated. So a set of parents in a particular posh part of town get a bit worried their kid won't get in and gang together and start a school. This is an incredibly inefficient way of doing things. I'm aware of how many scandals are currently being investigated by the CPS that have not yet come out and how many are coming out. When you put accountants in charge of schools, that actually doesn't improve the financial status of their schools. And the same with conflicts of interest in academies. These become more expensive things. I think what we're heading towards with our schools is a situation similar to the one we had with National Health Service, the one we created in 1948. We had to create the National Health Service in 1948 because we couldn't afford to fund the plethora of inefficient charity hospitals and private doctors that we had before it. The middle class couldn't afford it. I think we're going to hit that problem with our primary and our secondary schools in a few years' time. We've tried to protect their budgets for now, but it gets more and more expensive and inefficient to education the way we have been doing it. We will have to do something as radical as creating comprehensive schools as radical. As radical as free secondary education in the 1944 Act was radical. You can go back as radical as saying that children could stay on to school to 14 and so on. We're going to have to do it again. It's going to have to be cheap. But what is it going to be? My suggestion would be we always use the same sites, the schools will be on the same sites in the future, but I would look at having the governance of schools actually involving the people who work in them, which was the original charter school idea in the States, so that the people who are actually governing your schools are the teachers, a bit like Finland, so that you're in charge of yourself and some parents and some democratically elected councillors, but not back to the 1970s slightly Stalinist pattern of a chief education officer knowing best. But nobody, as far as I'm aware, is producing suggestions or models for if academies and free schools fail as an idea, what kind of idea do you do next? Which isn't just going back to the 70s. Before we click forward one more, universities. Universities are a brilliant example of a massive problem waiting to happen. £9,000 fees. We've got 3 years of young adults. They were hurst and groomed as children. All the advertising for universities is the same for 16 or 17 year olds and their parents. None of it had any small print saying the value of your degree may go down as well as up. You couldn't sell a car to a 17 year old like this legally. I'm sure there will be a court case at some point in the future saying I was coerced to take out that debt. By 2020 we will have 8 years worth of students with debt. Debt's unregulated. The Secretary of State, without going to Parliament, can alter terms and conditions of your student loan at any point, which they did 2 weeks ago. The government already expects half the debt not to be repaid. The amount you pay can be as much as £150,000 if you get a mildly good job. We already know that the vast majority of graduates are not going to get mildly good jobs because they haven't been getting by the age of 31, which is the oldest age we've got. It's not going to work. The student loan model simply doesn't financially work. It's happened because when it was proposed in 2010 by Peter Madison and Lord Bonis, and by Willis, it allowed people like me in universities not to have to sack any of our friends. We were given a choice in universities, except £9,000 fees or 20% cut in your funding, or 25%, which would be sacking at a faster rate than sacking in the 1980s. What did we do? We didn't protest. The student protested, but the academics didn't protest because you're not going to protest against something that means that if you don't get it, you're going to have to sack your colleagues. But it's a short-term thing that purely, even if it was a good idea, which I don't think it is a good idea, it just isn't going to work. It isn't working in the States, where the bubble is absolutely enormous, but it isn't going to work here. If you want one other reason to think why it's not going to work, we currently have increasing numbers of students coming from Europe every year. You have the right, if you're born in the European Union, to come and study in any university in England. I'm thinking, why on earth are there increasing numbers of students in Europe coming here to study each year when it's £9,000 a year? I can give you one little idea of why it's happening. When you go back to council Germany, if you've studied here and got a student loan for a student loan company here, which you have a right to, you're supposed to send an email to a student loan company telling them where you are. It's, unless we leave the European Union, the student loan system isn't going to work, because there's a growing group of people who won't be able to find it. Any of you, if you've got a student loan, just go live in another country and don't send that email. It's a great way of increasing emigration from your country. Anyway, I won't go on about universities, just to say we are slowly beginning to recognise that this isn't going to work. Only the most stupid financial hedge fund would actually buy the loan book off the government, because you can see what the potential payback of students is. 50% of young women go to university in the country. There's about 36% of young men in England. So while we're going to have an incredible revolution where women are going to be paid a lot more than men, very, very quickly, in all kinds of jobs 50% of people do, let's go forward again. But we need to sort out our universities, and that's going to be hard to do. And again, it may be a crisis that we have to make. Most complicated graph, but I think it's a positive graph over what can be done. This is IMF data, and it's a portion of GDP spent on public spending in a series of countries from 2002 to the projections from 2020 that the IMF made based on our budgets. Huge variety, from 55% of GDP going to public spending in some countries to just under 35%. The idea that we're all in some global race and it's the same everywhere, and you've just got to compete, and there's only one model and you can't do anything else, is just wrong. But if you haven't learned anything since you're 21 years old and you did your history degree, you may not realise at all. You may even believe that we're a high tax and high spend country, which the Chancellor told us we were recently. This is us. We were just under 40% of public spending in 2002. This is a really naughty rise that the New Labour did, public spending. It was really naughty, because that actually is how much you need to pay for that war that we shouldn't have done. Okay? It wasn't actually spending on people at home, it was paying for a war, which eventually we'll find out about. These rises are the bailout. This is Ireland. That's what happens if you decide to guarantee everybody's bank account, including overseas investors, up to however many million they've got in Irish banks. That's what you have to do. Here we are, down here. This is our apparently high tax, high spending country. Finland is surprised at the moment because Finland's had a small GDP drop. So how do they deal with GDP dropping in Finland? They increase the proportion of public services so public services wouldn't have to be cut. Way of behaving. But you can go down the list. Finland, France, Denmark, Belgium, Austria, Sweden, Italy, Portugal, Norway, Germany, Netherlands, even Greece, and there's Japan, which you might have thought was a lower spending than us. There's Canada, Spain, and there we are. And some more English-speaking countries, just believe it. But you have all this to play with in the realm of covered possibility. Perhaps if you decide that you want to tax a little bit more and spend a little bit more collectively. You are not suggesting something that is some radical idea that hasn't been tested. It is what is going on in most other rich countries of the world at the moment. I thought that John McDonnell should have stayed with that Osborne's rule about balancing the budget. And I may have been a bit childish about why I thought it, because if you did stay with that rule, if you have to have a balanced budget, you can balance the budget and increase public spending. It's really obvious how you do it. You have to raise taxes. And you can blame George Osborne for his rule. It means you have to do it. And how do you raise taxes? You raise taxes on wealth, not income. How do you raise taxes on wealth? 60-65% of our wealth is locked up in property. It's very hard to hide. It's almost impossible to move property. We have property taxes that are many times lower than New York, in London. I personally, because I'm not an economist, I'm a geographer, and John McDonnell was advised by a set of economists, including two Nobel Peace Prize winners. I would have stuck with the Osborne rule and said, because of Osborne's rule repeatedly, we're going to have wealth taxation in Britain on property. But it's only going to affect 5 or 2 or 1% of you who have really, really expensive property. And we move towards a New York, radical New York style flat property tax rate, and that money will allow us to do those kind of things as I've seen as decent in the average affluent country. What would happen? Property values begin to fall. What happens if property values fall? People's cost of living falls. Everybody has to pay rent or a mortgage, apart from a small group of people who are so well off that mum and dad give them enough money to buy a house at 18. But there aren't many of those. So if you have property values falling, it's the same as every trade union in the country winning their pay battles every year. We have property values that are twice those values in Germany at the moment. We have property values at a ridiculous level. But you're not allowed to talk about wanting to be in a country with property values and costs at the level that other European countries have, and at the same time having quality up to the level. Because the quality of rented property is higher in these countries where the costs are lower. You're thinking, how on earth can that be? How can people spend less on their housing and get better housing with better sound insulation and better rights? If you're finding it hard to understand that, it's not your fault. As you were taught maths in a way. It's because a small group of people are really making it in. They're not just making it in off those of you who are renting, they're making it in off me. I have a mortgage. Mortgages used to be something that a much wider society group of people could have. They're now something that only the well-off university professor can actually get. And my mortgage is at a really low interest rate, because it's a I had to borrow an absolute fortune. I will pay more back in my mortgage than all my relatives have ever paid back since we left Africa. Right back to the, you know, you can work out what loans any Dorney was ever able to do. And my mortgage payments would be twice the amount of money I paid for a very normal house. I'm being screwed as well by our housing system in this country. So it's another example of something you need to change at the top on the house. But until we don't see high house values as beneficial, until we realise just how dangerous these high values are, for people who think they're fairly well off but don't realise that there isn't a generation coming up who will be able to buy this house often, it's just landlords. And if landlords buy the housing, your children will be tenants for all their life. Until we begin to work that out, we're not going to sort that housing. Jobs, I've fed up skipped kind of generations. We're in a mess with jobs. Officially, we have a very low unemployment rate. It is very easy to get a really low unemployment rate. If you think unemployment rate is too high, simply reduce the unemployment benefits even more. If you take the unemployment benefits down to zero, yes, there's only about £10 a day at the moment anyway, but supposing we were to get rid of unemployment benefit, unemployment rate would be zero. Nobody goes to claim that something worth nothing. One reason why we have low unemployment is because people desperately do any job they can to avoid being signed on, because the amount of money is so little. Some people do two jobs, some do three jobs. We have a huge number of people on 0 hours contracts, who in other words are unemployed for large amounts of time and they're not being given any hours. We have an incredible increase in people who are registered as self-employed and aren't actually working that much. We are not particularly gainfully employed. The worst thing about unemployment is that we don't have a labour market. We are not in a position where we can sell our labour, move out of the job we don't like and into another one, as we used to, as some people in a much better functioning economy can do. And this ends up with many, many people doing jobs they do not want to do, which they don't feel the value. So about 10% of our labour force is now working in retail. This includes young people standing in shops, half our shops are clothes shops, standing in clothes shops, trying to grab somebody, even somebody like me. Yeah, you see me walking into a clothes shop, it's a lost cause. Asking if you could help them with something. The entire point of your job is to try to get somebody who doesn't want to buy something to buy it. The average item of clothing in this country is only worn 12 times. We need to get to a position where people can actually have some freedom over what jobs they do, so that those people who don't want to sell things, the people who don't want to buy them, don't have to sell things, the people who don't want to buy them. It may sound fanciful, the idea that you can move towards this, but if you look at Utrecht, Utrecht has the first major living wage experiment going on now to see what happens if you let a portion of people on benefits simply have those benefits and don't question them. You get to real employment freedom when you get a citizen's income up to a level where you can choose to work or not work. This may sound fanciful, but until people actually have choices, you don't have a labour market working. There are many citizens' incomes in the world already, they're all fairly low. I think we could get one at a European level, €1,000 a year. I'm going to why. I think that would be a good idea. We then just have to look at Utrecht for experiments. You can look at Stockholm. Stockholm has introduced an experiment which, well, they've had it before in the car factories and in parts of the public sector, where employees who are working 8 hours a day are asked to only work for 6 hours a day, but they still pay them as if they're working 8 hours a day. We find these ideas very strange, but that's because of where we are. There are lots of ways in which employment could be made much better. A key one is income inequality. If you take the best off 10th of people in this country and take their salaries, take a GP. GP maybe on £110,000 a year. If you move them back into real terms, into the salaries they got in the 1970s, still the best 10%, but pay what they got in the 70s, GP would be getting £50,000 a year. If we could slowly over a couple of decades moved towards the income inequalities of countries like the Netherlands, the income inequality that we used to have. The amount of money you save by not paying people at the top as much as you pay them is enough to employ all 1 million young adults who are employed on £10 an hour, full time, 15 times over. We have an absolutely enormous payload in this country because we pay people at the top so much. Why do we pay them so much at the top? Because they want to get a house. A GP just wants to get a house. In fact, a GP on £110,000 can't get a house of the same size as the house they used to be able to get for £50,000 in the 1970s. Because in the 1970s, a GP was in the 1%. Now, there are bankers and financiers and accountants above them. So you get this race of salaries up simply to get basic things like
housing like that.
Let's give you another graph. So click forward again in my very old-fashioned way. Okay. Other things that we could think about doing. This little table down here, which you can't see, is about a series of things that affect our health. What I must maintain is that cigarettes and alcohol don't correlate with inequality. It's very interesting, but you can essentially decide to smoke or not smoke, and it's not that affected by the society you're in, apart from the social norms. You can drink yourself to death or not on your own. In Japan, you're supposed to get somebody else to pour you a drink, so at least do it together. But alcohol and cigarette smoking don't correlate with inequality. Obesity does, really, really closely. So why should obesity correlate so closely with inequality? Why are the fattest people in the rich modern states? Why are we the second fattest? Why would I go to Japan and I'm the fattest person in the city? It really does happen. It's not just the pushing of food and sugar onto people, which is much higher in the unequal countries. 4% of our GDP goes on advertising. 4% of the US GDP goes on advertising. 2% of our GDP, 1% of mainland Europe's GDP on advertising. This includes making sure that fire drills can mechanise between arches. But also things like our transport systems. You cannot on your own decide that you're going to make London work so that you can walk to work or cycle to work. Some of you may be brave enough and you're doing it from cycling to work in London, but you cannot go and paint your own cycle lane. You cannot introduce 20 mile an hour zones on your own. And might be able to smoke on your own or drink on your own. So what you see here, this is a proportion of people who walk or cycle to work. In the Netherlands, it's 50% of the population are walking or cycling to work every day. 25% of people over 65 cycle. Well, for us, it's 1% of people over 65 cycle. They all appear to be in Oxford as well. these correlations are not perfect. Japan's low because the trains are so good. Right? Japan's had declining car ownership for 20 years now. You can't use car ownership as a sign of poverty in Japan. If you own a car in Japan, it means you live in the countryside. London's beginning to get that, by the way, but we just need to look and think, if we want to be thinner and healthier and not breathing in as much air pollution from car engines, we need to design our cities and work and housing and public transport so that we can use trains and trams and bikes and walk. But it requires a mindset that it's okay to plan and do things collectively and raise and spend public money to do it, rather than that people are best left to spend the money themselves because they know best how to do that. In many things, people do know how to spend money themselves. You know how to spend money yourself best when you're a repeat purchaser, when you buy an item many times. I'd never advocate a state picking your socks. You're a better person to pick your socks. You are a useless consumer on items that you only purchase once, like an education or a heart operation. You really don't want to become really skilled at knowing about heart surgery. And somewhere between education and a heart operation and socks, there is a line we have it wrong. I should edit that with warnings.
I told you I was only have 7 slides. How did these countries get there? In the Netherlands, a group of parents decided in the 70s that they'd had enough of their children being hit by cars. And they were ferocious enough to do it. There are always idiosyncratic stories about why more countries at the extreme. But that isn't the reason for this other set of countries. In the US, you have mayors of cities in Texas opposing the introduction of pavements because pavements are the root to socialism. When that kind of thinking becomes normal, in a way the mayor's right. Getting the pavements, somebody will want a cycle lane, somebody might then say, let's have some more high density dwellings towards the middle, and they might say, let's zone a bit so that you're not building your houses 20 miles out from, in a way it is the route to whatever the new socialism will be. I love these words like socialism, because you can find a series of them, like diggers and levelers and so on. There's always something, the word always changes. Now, I'm interested in what the future word will be. That's the key thing. It will not be the same as 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s socialism. It will be something else, but that's what we need. I think, do you want to click forward one more? Get one list at the end.
Yeah.
Oh no. So it's one more after this one. This is data ONS released by accident and then withdrew. George Mongeau very kindly grabbed. So ONS withdrew it because they underestimated the wealth of the top 1%. The reason for showing this is 99% of us, okay, there are differences there and they are actually quite steep. But we're not that well off. We're not actually living the life of Riley already. We are a GP in a 3-bed house in Fulham who can only just afford the mortgage. They can't split up with her partner because without her partner's income, they can't afford the mortgage and they won't go to school. And the GP's there. So 99% of people are in the same bucket. Within the 1%, there is absolutely no homogeneity, no sense of being together. At the bottom of the 1% are people on £170,000 income, working at jobs which are largely financial, increasing the incomes of people on $1 million a year, flying to Hong Kong to invest money of somebody better off than them, and living next door to that doctor in a 3-bed house. Halfway through the 1%, you've got people on incomes of £300,000 a year, wealth of a couple of million, who feel they're hard done by. We've actually interviewed them. They talk about how hard life is. You've got to remember, everybody in the 1% has to use private schools. It is not. You're really strange if you're in the 1% and you don't, because you've got school fees to worry about. Once you go to the top of the 1%, the richest 1,000 people, 500 of whom live in London in the country, so much better off than the vast majority and have doubled their wealth in just 5 years. But most of them do not feel better off because the best off 10 families in London have a quarter of all their wealth. So you can be in the Sunday Times rich list and you can just look at the top of it and you can go, I'm not really rich because I've got 10 times less. The curve is staggering. Let's do the last slide and then I can open it up because I think that's long enough. A different map. We put the oceans back in now, but it's still the world shaped by population. So here we are. I always think, I don't know if you can see down here, anybody from New Zealand? No, too small a sample. One little dot there for Auckland. I always look at this and think, this explains why people want to go from New Zealand to the bright lights of London. What you're seeing is the traditional Earth at night map, the one that you see on a normal map. You see it in the normal map, you think that's where people are, where the lights are, that's where people are, where the lights aren't, it's largely unpopulated. On this map, there's people everywhere. So there are only two reasons for not seeing any light here. One reason, and it's a common reason in much of Africa, is there still isn't much electricity as a farm. But the other reason is that people in the areas that are darker have decided not to spend money shining lights up to the sky so that somebody can draw a map of where they are. It's a map of waste, if you like. And Tokyo was the brightest spot on this map about 10 years ago. It's still pretty bright, but Cairo's kind of beating it. Tokyo stopped being the brightest spot on the map after the tsunami. When the tsunami hit, they had to turn all the nuclear power stations off. The nuclear power stations supplied 25% of electricity in Tokyo. So you have to turn the lights off. In Tokyo, you have to say the lift was only to be used by people who had to use the lifts. You had to turn the air conditioning off in summer, which did scare people, but didn't result in a higher death rate. But you can actually reduce your electricity consumption by 25% over the night if you are forced to do it. In Denmark, by 2020, half their electricity is going to come from wind power. There is no Green Party in Denmark because all seven of the main parties are green. And when you go to Denmark and you say to them, what will you do when the wind stops? The answer you get immediately is, we won't be able to use the washing machines and we'll all smell together until the wind starts. My optimism in this is geographical optimism. If you just stick yourself in this country, the last 30 or 40 years in this country, it is utterly, utterly impressive. But as soon as you begin to look around other parts of the world, you can see different things are not just possible, they are normal. There are countries like Switzerland in which income inequality has been falling, and the Netherlands income inequality has been falling, countries in which housing systems will be getting better and more affordable. There are countries like Japan in which people are using fewer and fewer cars. We are just the bottom of the pile, I'm afraid, when it comes to it. The saddest thing is you'll find in every other country in the world, people in the very richest, a few people in the very richest 20%, who will speak out and will say things like, if you pay me twice as much, I wouldn't work any harder. If you pay me half as much, I'd work just as hard. Or will speak out in the States like Warren Buffett, say it's wrong that I pay less tax than my secretary. We don't have anybody. We're the only country in which world that has not a single member of the affluent elite who speaks out against their own affluence. I think it's because of our strange history of being the richest, most powerful country on the earth 100 years ago. I think we're still coping with becoming a normal country. But don't be depressed about the future. But please help me come up with much better ideas than mine about what could be done for our children and our grandchildren. It's that far forward. Because if you don't have a message that says that our children and our grandchildren could have better lives than us, how do you expect people to behave any differently now if you've got nothing to offer them? Thank you very much.
Everybody, I'm going to introduce myself, but I'm the head of ethnography and I'll be chairing the questions. Thanks very much for talking, Danny. I thought I'd start actually. We've been running a series of seminars and it's all about, you know, asking our speakers to kind of put provocations to us about how to create equality. And something that you were talking about, which many of the things you were talking about made me think of myself out on a cold winter's day in Manchester. I was the last of the students not to have to pay tuition fees. And there's a photo of me and I'm standing there and I'm grinning. I'm like, ha ha, this is fun. There weren't very many of us out that day. And we would never have, when I think about it, when you were talking, I think I'd never have known how we were sleepwalking in the increase in tuition fees. And it kind of made me think about sort of moments of radical change, and not only radical in terms of creating new things, but they're also radical in terms of loss. Because that, the tuition fee introduction is actually radical change, but it happened very slowly. As soon as you said you could charge people for their university education, all other education forms became, you know, open to the market in that way. And it made me think about the kind of change that we're talking about creating. You said that we couldn't do it on our own. But one question is, how do we do it then? And also, is it better to halt great loss or is it better to create great change?
We'll find out. There is a chance that because we did the most ridiculous increase in tuition fees from 3,000 a year to 9,000,
that may result in something better in the future out of the ridiculous situation we put ourselves in. But if they'd increased it from 3 to 4 or 5, you could have gradually kind of weaned people into it. You wouldn't have such ridiculous figures. It was just a tuition fee, let alone your maintenance loan and all the other loans you're going to have the rest of your life. It just was an incredible event. And we've got a tiny committee of 8 people, Vice Chancellor of the University of Birmingham, one taking student, meet for a few months, suggested by various civil servants in the Labour government that they should just go for a free-for-all, new Labour government. Quite a pact is made between Conservatives and Labour at the time of the 2010 election. Nick Clegg is told that what he wants is apparently unaffordable, and of course you do have that problem of the country suddenly become poorer. And it just happened. What I find interesting about it is you're going to have these 8 years of students by 2020. You've got all their parents, you've got their grandparents, they're still alive. You've got all the parents of all the children going up into this system at the moment who are slowly going to work out that their children are being asked to sign up to a loan, the terms and conditions of which can be changed at any point without their agreeing to it. This, we very, very quickly get towards the majority of the population being badly done by. This same group, because this is the better off half the population, are the ones who are going to have to pay to sort the mess out somehow themselves. But it is in their interest to sort it out, because they're either going to sort it out sooner or later. The longer we leave tuition fees going, and they've gone up to £10,000 by the way, in the next year, the bigger the bubble and the mess is towards the end. Or maybe the more of our children will lose to Europe. University used to be about going away from home when I went. It was exciting, there were no mobile phones, you got on the train, you went, you came back after 10 weeks, and then after 3 years you left home completely at 21. University in England is no longer about that. It's something you do while you're still a child, and then you go back and live with mum and dad at 21. If you want your children to have the experience you had if you went to university, the way to do it is to go to Germany, where it's free, go to Greece, my favourite is Crete, by the way, but if you want any suggested places to go. The government, for an average student, are bribing you £70,000 to learn to speak German or Greek or Dutch. You don't even have to learn this to do some of these courses. So one possibility is that we will begin to see young people work out. It's only a degree. Yeah. Half of all people get a degree. So this thing that half of all people get, is it really worth this amount of money? If you feel you have to get one, why not get one that makes you stand out and go and get one from another country where they won't charge you? Of course, if we vote to leave Europe, suddenly our children will have no right whatsoever, and there'll be overseas students in these other countries. Although many of these other countries actually don't charge overseas students anything either, because they have a different model. They actually see education, you know, that phrase, as a gift from one generation to the other, a kind of weird way of thinking. But actually education is some commodity that we're giving you so that you can sell your labour for a higher amount in the marketplace in a few years' time and screw other people over with your knowledge. We are a weird country. We train, I think it's 200,000 people in accountancy and finance, 4 to 5 times more than in medicine. Apparently, more people in accounting and finance are trained in Britain than in all the rest of Western Europe put together. So there are lots of things that are odd about us, but are in our psyche, that mean that if you suggest that the way we're doing things is wrong, you can sound very strange. And if you describe what we do to somebody from another nearby European country, they quietly and fairly politely ask, why are you doing that?
I think a lot of our thing is we don't think things through. Nobody thinks beyond next week. Nothing nowadays seems to be thought through for long term. And certainly with education, we just don't think it through. How do we change the mindset? How do we get people to say, stop, think 10 years ahead? But they don't. They're just there grabbing the money.
I'm not sure that's true, actually. I think I think what actually happens is the people that want a policy like that think about it quite hard, but they think about two things. They think about the policy and how it will play out, and then they're thinking about how to sell it. And I think you're absolutely right that policies look like they're being designed on the back of an envelope, but they're sold by people who know exactly what's under
the common. They don't partly. The small group who've got this, the key thing, well, one, it wasn't going to affect them because they could pay 9,000 up front. So they're only paying 27. The alternative of being in a normal economy where you pay higher taxes would actually cost them more. So that's what, there's a little bit of selfishness from the very rich who wanted this. But also, this group honestly thought this would create a better education system because they love markets so much that they think, and they've got it into the US, they've got it into Australia, and apparently Korea, that's the only places that actually happen. They believe in their heart of hearts that a market is efficient, it's efficient for everything, and you need to turn it all to a market. They don't understand that it is really, really easy to fool 17-year-olds and their parents on their one-off shot of buying. So there are universities in the States that spend more on marketing than on their teachers.
I chair a primary school governing body in Tottenham, and a few years ago our school was run absolute bottom, all the same, and we knew what was going to happen when I took over governing body. I knew exactly what was going to happen, and it came to pass that the academy broker turned up. I am proud to say we saw them off. We saw Gove off, we saw the academy broker off, because we were smart. You're talking about ideas and so on. I mention this because I think it was a searing experience dealing with Michael Gove's department, his advisors, his feds, his broker, because the overriding thing was about bullying and intimidation. That's them. I think the overriding thing that's going on in education now, and it may be the same in the university sector, I certainly think it's true right through education, is fear. I think this government is, and I think the biggest thing we have to look at, because I think they're deeply ideological, I don't think it's allowed just by chance, charter schools, they've nicked the whole thing from America. They believe in the privatisation and marketisation of education. And I think the difference between the way the public see it is that people don't understand it, actually. You know, I've told people the story about our school. I've told people, I in my personal life, I meet people who are wealthy because they're, you know, magistrates, really. And they are they're people who know things, who are connected. They have absolutely no idea what's happening in the world of education. Absolutely none. When you talk to them about under fives, which I do know a lot, it's like you are some sort of nerdy anorak. I am. I'm a bit to be an under-fives anorak. And they don't understand it. And if you described what this government is doing with under-fives to a Martian, they would say, are you completely mad? Is this country completely round the bend? And it is round the bend, there's no doubt about it. Because, but unlike the health service, where people do under everybody, because everybody uses the health service, not everybody uses a school. It's been segmented, fragmented, broken up. Free schools, academies, private businesses, Lord Harris the carpet magnet, Aldridge the capita bloke. They've all got their trusts and their academies, and they run that private education system.
You're right. You're
and I know I'm not coming up with an idea. I mean, well, I suppose my idea is let's have some socialism back. And some, it seems to me some of the old ideas were some of the best ideas, really. But when you talk to people about those ideas, like having a universal education system, or like paying proper taxes, or like having childcare free at the point of use, or my dad's favourite was everybody should have free public transport, people think you are. They think I'm crazy. Mm. They do.
They do, but it's worth being crazy and saying it. And one reason, apart from the fact it would be a good idea, is if you say you should have free public transport, amazing 2p to travel all day on the tube. So there's a generation of people who got to learn London by turning up as children and just travelling underground for a day for two penny. I don't think it's as bad as you think, this is what I say. So
maybe you didn't experience Michael
Douglas. No. Well, I have, I mean, one, I left a fairly normal Midlands town when I was 18. Yeah. I came back to it 2 years later to find out all our secondaries have been made academy.
Yeah.
And now exclude children at 16 and don't, you know, it's horrible coming back to your city and watching it create the divides before we got rid of it in the 1930s. But I think there are three groups of people there. There's the SPAD, and one of the key ones was Dominic Cummings. He features big in that Injustice book. But of course, lovely Dominic decided to write all his ideas down in a thesis that he published on the internet. So you actually have Dominic's theory of the world, which includes that the richest 1% of people have the clever genes and deserve to be riches. And he's got it all in there.
Have a great email from him.
Yeah. So Dom, and he's going to lead the, is it the Going Out of Europe campaign, I think? So
no, no, it's about our store, because we
Oh, yeah, for your email, but he's still on the scene. Anyway, there are a very small number of people like Dominic Cummings who are truly wedded to this, but they are, I've searched for them, and they are tiny. And they're disjointed because he didn't go to a normal school or a normal university. There are then another group, like the carpet magnates and so on, who are really seeking a bit of self-aggrandizement. So they want to be associated with academy chains and so on because they want to be seen as doing good, do-gooders, nice people, philanthropists. But if you could find another way to stroke their egos, they would go for that. They don't actually... They don't have a theory of education themselves. They've been sold this one, that, you know, you bring business in, it'll make it better. They'll get very embarrassed very quickly when things were going to begin to go wrong. When all these people being hired by these schools who've never been given basic lessons about child protection, you're going to get sex scandals in our schools. So the second group who go with the programme, but they're wanting people to think that they are nice benefactors. And there's a third group, as in the Conservative Party, you were just there because they were kind of born into it. But in the past, when the Conservative Party moved to the left, which it did in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s and 60s, were the same people who helped Macmillan build more council houses and Labour with them. And I can see the same thing in Labour. There are a small group of true Blairites, I call them the militant tendency. So Lord of Dolies, but a tiny number of people in Labour who truly believed in this Blairite thing. Then there's a wider group of people who kind of went with it. And what's interesting about that wider group, and I'm not a member of any party, I should say, but you can see which sort of side I'm. But I've been to both party conferences. It's interesting to see the difference. There's this bigger group of people who kind of went with that Blairism thing because it was fashionable and it fitted, who are now not leaving a Labour Party, it's moving in another direction. And some of them are fitting very well into the new one. And then there is the group of people who never believed this was a good idea in the first place, some of whom stayed in that party, who now tell people like me, you should have stayed with us, you should have had faith, it would change. Small numbers of people are truly committed to ideas. Larger numbers of people go with the flow of them. And it is possible to have the flow move again. You're always going to have small groups believing in certain things. There's been a small group who believe vehemently in corporal punishment. Margaret Thatcher, the first thing she voted for as a new MP with six old men was to retain birching in the Navy, because she thought it was good. There will still be people in Britain who think that corporal punishment is a good idea. They've got no chance of bringing it back now. But that, we had it in my school. Luckily it was banned in the state schools. If you paid money in the private schools, you could still get cane for a bit longer. But it's now illegal in the, you know. So, and there are many examples like this. There will be people who still believe that it is very, very wrong that we are not inflicting physical damage on children to make them disciplined. But you can beat them. And I think the same with the idea that a, you know, a market in education is the right way to go. It's Milton Friedman who thought it was an idea that was good.
Yeah,
sorry.
There was a question.
Sorry,
I can jump in.
I can jump in. I've got a friend here. Let me jump.
Is that right?
Well, actually, the gentleman that
reminded
you was doing my
apologies.
Sorry.
Thanks for a very interesting talk. I think some of the data on the slides you put, you know, the information is very, very interesting, very impactful. It's just an observation or a question. I can understand why incumbent governments choose to ignore a lot of this. You know, this is not convenient, it doesn't support their case. But there's a lot of evidence. I mean, for example, I was listening to some debate about productivity, you know, someone from the Labour Party the other day. Weren't mentioning any of the research which shows, you know, the correlation between, you know, GDP growth in a country and economic prosperity and social inequality. Yeah. You know, there's a strong, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, what is preventing our opposition parties, our Labour parties, and people to, you know, from actually using this data, using this evidence, and actually having a different dialogue? I mean, we may be, you know, mathematically illiterate,
yeah,
but most of the populace isn't stupid.
Yeah.
So what is it that's getting in our way that's actually preventing us and getting, you know, our politicians and people actually engaging us in some of this stuff? Because if more people knew about this, more people actually, they would actually start asking, yeah, some serious questions about the direction that our governments are taking.
It's again, small number of people. So if you think of the shadow cabinet, the group who are happy in the shadow cabinet, which isn't yet most of the shadow cabinet, I'm optimistic, I think. You're only talking about 3 or 4 people, advised by another 6 or 7 paid people at the moment, because they're still hiring their advisors. They've only established their economic advisory committee in the last 3 weeks, you know, with Piketty and so on it. So it's tiny and that's new. The next thing you've got to do is to say, how do we tell people in Britain that people even in France are 10 to 15% more productive than they were? Because we've had 20 years of people telling you that the French is a basket case, they don't work hard and so on. So you've got to work out that the median family income in France is about 4,000 euros higher than in Britain. They're better off. And that's before the housing costs. But if you're a political party and you're faced with telling people that for 20 years they've been told a lie about the French, it's quite hard to do that immediately. You can do it with Germans now. That's what we've done. You know, nobody thinks of Germany as an economic basket case anymore, and Germany's more productive, but so is the Netherlands. All these countries are more productive. You've then got to explain why. And I think you just got to use anecdote. My favourite anecdote is Japan. Cleaners are paid twice as much in Japan, if not more, than cleaners are paid here. Have you ever seen a train cleaned in Japan? The way it works, the train pulls into the station, all the cleaners line up, bright green jumpsuits, get on at each carriage, the mechanical seats from the 1960s swivel round, they clean the carriage in about 16 seconds, all get off the train and salute. But they're paid twice as much. People do better jobs. Pay is respect. You're a fool working hard for crap pay. And we've strung our payouts so far that we've paid for the big ones. But also, the other big thing they do in Japan, because the cost of labour is so high, because people are paid below the bottom, is you don't ask people to do jobs that don't need doing. So if you want to get a cup of coffee in Japan, the most common way is you go to a machine that gives it you. And you might not like that, but, you know, do you really want people spending all day making cups of coffee so you can have a cup of coffee made by a person rather than a machine?
Yeah, sorry. Point first. I'm glad to hear about sort of dancing conversions of some of the ex-sinners, because I remember being in a situation where Estelle Morris arrived in the authority I was in to privatise the education system with a team from Deloitte,
yeah,
and a group of defence contractors who were about to take over the service. So it's nice to hear that there is change. But anyway, I was going to ask how you end the sort of Faustian pact people have made in gearing with wealth, with properties. You were saying about people who have huge gearings on mortgages, why are they ever going to vote for property going down? And the other point is, I think you made a point somewhere else, where we've created a generation of rentier legislators who are busy increasing their own personal wealth,
yeah,
and are running out, are finding it difficult to find, keep track of the number of houses they bought for their children.
Yeah.
So how are we going to get them to change their mind?
It's 48 of the players.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
48 at the moment. Yeah. Things are, I think Estelle Morris in a different environment would have been seen like Barbara Castle, and yeah. the problem was what was around her, and that made
yeah, okay.
Sarah Teber's an interesting one. Over, you know, Sarah Teber, at the point when she resigned in tears, knew that over a million people had been sanctioned, and that the sanctions were bigger than all the fines in the Magistrates' Courts of England. And, you know, so we have, I think we should give Sarah Teber more credit, but Estelle would have been braver. The new schools minister was the headmaster of John Leggett School in Scunthorpe for 10 years. Actually run a school. You know, it's a shadow school minister, so you're not Nicky. Anybody know what Nicky Morgan's background is? Any job she's done? Something she knows about? No.
Didn't she train as a chemist?
Like a chemist. Margaret Thatcher did make some ice cream. It was particularly disgusting.
Softy freeze.
Yeah. And that's one thing. I think people are going to come to understand that their houses are not worth what they think they're worth. It's going to be a hell of a shock discovering that although you think your house is worth £300 or £400 or £600,000, unless we have mass immigration of the world's very rich, or we become almost a completely fragmented society, you're never going to realise that. It's going to take some time.
With a mortgage.
But mortgages were set up with the idea that you and her, because that was the one, you and her would stay together for 25 years, keep your jobs and pay regularly every month. Mortgages really are quite a scam. I don't know when people are going to work out that the housing isn't worth what we come to think it's worth. Housing is a roller coaster. UBS has said that we're bubble territory now, it's been called before. The important thing for ideas is there needs to be a series of ideas ready for if it is this autumn, or the autumn in 3 years' time, when the housing market goes down, you need things immediately to suggest that you can do. If you haven't been planning for that, that's in there. If you do want to get house prices going down, by the way, just vote to leave Europe. Spend 18 months talking about how much you hate these people who've come over from Europe, just to discourage people, and then vote that they don't have the right to be here to work and that nobody else can come in. Fastest way to get a housing market crash. It's a quarter of MPs are landlords. That was an unforeseen cock-up. When Maggie did that little deal where they didn't put up their salaries, but she gave them those, she didn't realise she was making them into landlords. But it is tricky. They changed the rules on the register of public interest and said they don't have to declare the increasing asset values of that housing. The good news, though, is that the new intake of MPs, the young ones, they don't own anything. And we've changed the housing allowances and rules to mean that they may end up with one property, but they're never going to end up with two. So we've got an old generation moving through who've milked it. This is politically across the board. All of Michael Meacher had 12 flats in London. But that generation is going to go through and go. The young MPs, some of them are actually discovering what it's like to try and rent in London. The first one.
Okay,
so that's
our
last question. I think it's the gentleman
in the
room.
You said about people,
yeah,
who's
George. No, please go ahead.
Perhaps a penultimate question.
Acidity.
Right. You said about people, different small groups of people who believe different things. Does it ring true for me? Because I've been 16 years as a local councillor, and what I've noticed is that the Blairites were running things and don't actually believe in alternative theories. They just think there is one way of doing it. And but the explanation for me came reading and listening to Tony Judd, who talked about the default position which we've had since the Tory kind of neoliberal view of the world was advocated. And it really, what I found kind of incredibly sort of frustrating and curious, I wonder what you think about this, what you think about Jack, is that you can't sort of say, but there's another theory, or what's that what they do in Copenhagen, or whatever, you know, or they're not interested in there is another way of doing things.
Yeah, but they didn't like it. I think the way to think about that era that you lived through is it would have been...
Was now.
It's now. It's still, I'm optimistic it may be coming to an end. Mm. But if you're not optimistic, you know, if you sort of say, oh, this won't last, we'll just go back to normal, it will. You know, unless you actually say it could change now, it's not going to change now. Imagine that you were in local government, but in 1910, and you were a laissez-faire young conservative alderman, and you watched your party move to the left, particularly as people like Michael Young go and do things, and you get this terrible conservative party in the 50s and 60s, which is completely wrong. And when you, as that laissez-faire alderman, say to them, but we shouldn't be doing any state housing, we shouldn't be having, you know, people going to schools where they don't have to pay, it's terrible. And then the Conservative Party in the 50s and 60s won't talk to you. It's been the same the other way around. Labour moved with the political movement and it left people behind. So if you went to the Labour Party conference in Brighton, the really funny thing was watching an outsider from the party, a set of very happy 60 and 70 year olds, and a set of very happy 20 year olds, and people up to 35, and a set of very unhappy people of around about my age wearing suits, who are managing to hide their unhappiness until they've had 5 pints of beer, and then it all spilled out. And that Blairite middle-aged generation suit wearing have had a shock, because there's an older and a younger generation who want things differently. And I like the alliance sort of people who can remember and people who are being screwed now. I think that could help. The last one?
Well, maybe it's good as the last one, because it's kind of frivolous actually, but correlation does not imply causation, but it does seem that in all of the charts that you presented today, that speaking English means that things are going to be a bit rubbish. I'm curious about this, and the factors that may well have come behind this. We've spoken a lot about going over to the US. Is it perhaps because Japan's educational conferences are inaccessible to him, you know, as an example? And indeed, is it a concern that we look within our own language bubble?
The English language countries are odd. I think there is a connection, although not to America, because we didn't manage to keep them. It's empire. We had an empire. It was our empire that allowed us to become rich. Orwell actually said this, and not Michael Young. We thought we became rich because we built ships and we had mills in Manchester. But we became rich because we forced people to buy our ships and forced them to buy our cotton goods. And as India got independence, as all those countries in Africa got independence, and with a lag of some decades where their markets became free, the way we used to make money from our dominant position went. And the reaction to that, of finding that you're so much worse off relatively than your parents and grandparents. You know, Cameron's dad was a stockbroker. You only got to go back a couple more generations and they owned entire slave plantations. You know, he ends up having to work for Carlton TV for only £90,000. It's, if you see it from that point of view, you can see a group of people on the right from the rich in Britain who want to put the great back in Britain again. Because there was a time when we were the richest people on the planet and they feel that it slipped. They never thought it was our exploitation of empire that made it rich. They thought it was the leadership of their forebears. And this is a particular problem that England has, that the USA is going to get because it's the richest country now. It's not a problem that the rest of Europe has. And I think that makes it excusable why we're in such a strange state, because nobody else was as rich as us, has lost as much, and didn't understand that it wasn't our supreme ability of the great white race that made us so rich. And that's a peculiar English problem. And everything from our universities to our class system to why we have these schools. Mainland Europe doesn't have private schools. You know, we don't even know they don't have private schools. In the twin city to me, Bonn, school teachers in Bonn compared to Oxford find it hard to rank the schools. They're all pretty good. They do have one private school in Bonn. It's for the very, very slow children of the very, very rich. And there's one famous alumni at that school that all Germans know about and we don't know about. And it's Prince Philip. But people in more equal countries, particularly Japan, but also are politer. They're less bombastic. The more unequal you get, like Americans, the more, you know, I'm going to tell you how to do everything, I've worked it all out. As you go between countries, you write about not being causative as well. As you go towards more equal countries, people become more modest. They don't believe they have all the answers. They're less sure of themselves. They trust each other more, but they trust other people's ideas more. More unequal countries are much more likely to tell people, this is how you should do it. We've got lots of problems. But the nice thing is, the empire was some time ago. You know, give it another 50 years, I think we might have just about got over it. Thank you.
Okay, will you join me in giving a funny Thank you.